Claiborne Carson, professor of history at Stanford, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project there, and we are talking about nonviolent resistance as it was conceived of and practiced by Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. Our other guest is Dennis Dalton. He teaches political science at Barnard College. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. was a Baptist. Gandhi was a Hindu, and as Dennis has told us, was strongly influenced by the Hindu religion and Hindu principles. How was King able to square his developing sense of a religious calling and his own religion with a nonviolence in India based on some other form of religious thought?
Well, I think he always felt that that Christianity provided the spirit and motivation for his own action, and Gandhi furnished a method. I think what he took from Gandhi was primarily the ideas, the methods, the concept of nonviolent resistance. But he was certainly motivated by his own Christian beliefs. But again, as was the case with Gandhi and the Hindu religion, it wasn't that everyone who, obviously every Christian does not practice nonviolence. So what he was doing was drawing inspiration from, I think, his own interpretation of social gospel Christianity and really shaping his Christian beliefs to fit his desire to change society. And I think that there was always a tension there. King never succeeded in converting even his fellow Black Baptist ministers, the majority of them, to adopt his political and social agenda. That was one of his struggles throughout his life, was to try to bring people over to the nonviolent message. And I think it's important to point out, particularly in the American context, that King was not the whole struggle. Obviously, he faced people like Malcolm X and even people in SNCC who used nonviolence simply as a tactic. He always felt that he was carrying on an intellectual and political debate within the movement. Not everyone was going to come over to his side.
You have pointed to a memorandum that King wrote in late 1956 in which he outlines his idea of nonviolence, which you say he pretty much followed and carried for the rest of his life. What kinds of principles did King articulate in this memo?
Well, I'm trying to think of the one you're referring to. It probably, if you talked about late 56, right at the end of the Montgomery bus boycott, he was going through a number of changes. At the beginning of the boycott, for example, he applies for a gun permit. And, you know, it's only after he begins to meet with people like Bayard Rustin and others who had been longtime Gandhians, that he really gets a deeper understanding of Gandhian principles. And so it's in the context of actually participating in a struggle that he develops many of his insights. And I think that's what makes them so powerful, is that it wasn't like he came to the movement with a set of preformed ideas, but he really tested these ideas, tested all of his doubts in the crucible of a movement. And by the end of it, I think he understands that it is a powerful method. In fact, he describes it as the most powerful method available to oppressed people. To me, the essence of what his message is that it's an answer to the question, how do oppressed people or people without a lot of resources liberate themselves? That's an important question, particularly in the 20th century, when you have many people around the world striving for their freedom, for their liberation, against far more powerful forces arrayed against them. And I think it's King and Gandhi who speak to the needs of those people and say that you can turn what seems to be your weakness into a strength through this method.
Well, in the face of the kind of oppression that African Americans faced, is there a sense that he adopted Gandhian methods because of an expedient? Because, and he does talk about this at some length in his writings, that he was worried that if nonviolence was not done, if it was not performed, then somehow that the resentment, the anger, the justifiable frustration of the black community could rise up and become a very, very violent force in the form of riots or revolution. And so could we see his adoption of Gandhi's methods merely as a way of channeling some of that energy to a less violent way of being?
Well, when you say merely, I'm sure you don't mean that in a pejorative sense, because that's an important element. You know, certainly whenever you have people who are oppressed facing injustice, there's going to be resentment built up. And I think what King understood, and I think it's fairly easy to see in most cases, is that when you don't provide a positive outlet for that resentment, it turns inward. It becomes self-destructive. It feeds self-hatred and self-destructive actions, and which you see so much of. And in terms of the African-American experience, and certainly the experiences of many other colonialized people around the world, that you see so much of the violence directed against each other. But I think that he also understood that it was not just a message for the oppressed, that ultimately the arguments for nonviolence apply as much to the oppressor as to the oppressed. I mean, it may be that the oppressed have fewer options at their disposal, you know, that violence might be suicidal if the force that you're fighting against is much stronger than you are. But ultimately, violence, even when you're in the stronger position, can end up to be very self-destructive. And I think that that's one of the things that I think has led to a lot of misconceptions of his message, because it's often used as, well, you know, I mean, I've seen people make an argument for nonviolence, well, this is something that black people should use in the United States. But then the same people would turn a blind eye toward the use of violence on their behalf by the state, by the police forces or the military forces of the state. So I think what he was arguing for is a consistent understanding of that in all cases, when you use violence to achieve your ends, you are creating establishing a foundation for violence to come back or destructiveness to come back in the future in a very harmful way. So I think that he would certainly have argued in the last 30 years, for example, that every time African Americans become discontented and that breaks out in violence, then King's message is used as a way of quieting that violence, as opposed to the consistent use of the message against all forms of violence.
From the Archives on Nonviolence, that is the voice of Claiborne Carson, who directs the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project at Stanford University. He is the co-editor of the Papers of Martin Luther King Jr., and he wrote a wonderful section on Dr. King for people who don't have time maybe to read a whole book. There is an encyclopedia on nonviolence. It's called Protest, Power, and Change, an encyclopedia of nonviolent action from ACT UP to women's suffrage. Clay Carson talks about the impact that Gandhi had on King and how King developed and practiced his own form of nonviolence. And I want to bring Dennis Dalton back in a moment, but you wrote in that piece that Dr. King's contribution to the tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience was more as a popularizer of Gandhian ideas than as a tactical or philosophical innovator, and I'd like you to expand on that a little bit.
Well, I think all I meant there is that I don't think King ever presented himself as the as an innovator in that respect. I mean, much of the ideas that he drew upon during his life of struggle came from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, from people like Bayard Rustin, from many others who he himself, James Lawson, would say were more, I think, well-informed about Gandhian principles than King, although by the end of his life, I think he certainly was one of the most well-informed people in the world with respect to this. But I think he didn't start out that way. It was something that developed over time. But I think that clearly in the years since, King has become a symbol of the nonviolent struggle, I think in a way that's equivalent to Gandhi. I mean, if you look at the ways in which, in the last 30 years, the struggles that have gone on in the world, and often the King-Gandhian tradition is not given enough credit for the tremendous amount of change that has taken place in ways that we could never have expected. You know, the struggle in Poland and Eastern Europe in general, in Burma. You know, I remember the picture on the front of the New York Times magazine with the students in Tiananmen Square carrying the "We Shall Overcome" sign. The students in Korea fighting for democracy and singing "We Shall Overcome." Clearly, in part because of the tremendous power of the communications media during King's life, that message of the freedom struggle, the African-American freedom struggle, has reached the world in a way that has had a tremendous influence on subsequent freedom struggles.
No question. Let me bring back Dennis Dalton, who teaches political science at Barnard College, a longtime expert on Mahatma Gandhi. As we bring it up to the present and you see large actions, nonviolent actions in Seattle and D.C. and Headwaters, and you see Swords to Plowshares activists who are chaining themselves to nuclear weapons, to what extent do you think Gandhi's brand of nonviolence informs what is being done today?
Gandhi would distinguish, I believe, between satyagraha and duragraha, and he himself was highly critical of much of the actions in India as being those of duragraha and not satyagraha. Remember the distinction that I tried to make before, that is, that Gandhi made. Satyagraha is the application of nonviolence in a way that reflects not only a concern to avoid physical violence, but mental violence, spiritual violence, psychological violence, violence of a kind that speaks of, as King said so well, the violence of the spirit. And Gandhi said, if satyagraha descends into duragraha, then the whole movement will fail, because the force of nonviolence cannot flow except from that of pure satyagraha. I think that he would be critical of some of what is going on in the United States and what has happened as being duragraha and not satyagraha. You started out, I think, we're at the outset of the program, yes, by saying that many people engaged in the Seattle action and other actions have been committed to nonviolence, determined to show nonviolence. To the extent that they have been able to do that and maintain that through nonviolence, then I think the movement has succeeded. And we need to reinforce it. I would say that we need to reinforce it. However, to the extent that it has engaged, and this once again happened in India too, so we're not being purist about this, it has happened during King's days and Gandhi's days in India. But once it descends into that psychological violence that shows that we address the adversary not in terms of a spirit of compassion or concern, but rather in a spirit of enmity and mutual hostility, that kind of attitude will not do from a Gandhian point of view.
What I hear a lot is that Gandhi's brand of nonviolence would not work in today's world because of the historical context in which Gandhi operated, that the British government, the colonial government in India, was comparatively benevolent, even though, of course, there were massacres of Indian people at the time, and that conditions have changed such that nonviolent pacifism really doesn't hold water in today's world. There has to be strict limits on something like that. What do you think?
Well, I think I want to agree with what Claiborne Carson has already said about King's contribution. But to add to that, of course, we have to remember first, King was a practitioner of nonviolence, not mainly a theorist of nonviolence. However, he, like Malcolm X, was assassinated at age 39, and we don't know, as we can understand, what might have happened in terms of him developing the theory of nonviolence, because after all, he did progress a great deal in his short lifetime and did become, as Claiborne Carson just said, by the end of his life, a person who more than anyone else in the United States understood the idea of nonviolence. It was really extremely important in that respect. Now, as he developed this concern for nonviolence and developed the idea of nonviolence, more and more he became attuned to practicing it in a way that was magnificent. That is, I think the Montgomery bus boycott, the first of these actions, were real demonstrations of just how nonviolence could work in the United States. And as he did that, and this is my main point, he gave the lie to the argument that Gandhian nonviolence was not transferable. That is, he proved that it was transferable. He made it different, certainly in the United States, but he showed that it could work in a context quite different from that of the United States. And I think the difference was great between India and the United States, and he showed that it was, as he argued, a method that had universal application. That's immensely important, because if that example of how it worked in the United States can be appreciated in the 20th century, then in this century, certainly, we can go beyond that and show how it can work again in the United States and in other contexts that were as different as the two contexts of India and the United States. There is no limit to what the power of nonviolence can do if it is truly applied and developed with the kind of leadership, of course, that King showed.
Clay Carson, your assessment of modern-day nonviolent protest movements, and I also want to ask you, how important is it to you that people practicing nonviolence have a kind of moral and philosophical grounding that Gandhi or King might have shared?
Well, I would certainly, for the most part, definitely agree with what Dennis Dalton has just said, because I think it's clear that nonviolence works best for people who understand its underlying principles. I think I would add, though, that in both the world of Gandhi and the world of King, they were part of much larger movements, in which there were only a handful of people who had what I would call a Kingian or a Gandhian sense of nonviolence and a commitment to that as a way of life. Then you have a lot of people arrayed on a spectrum from people who are highly committed like that to people who are simply, as I said, using it as a tactic. And I think that's the way it really works in the real world. We could wish it otherwise, and I think in some ways what we find is that for most people it's something that develops over time through experience. I think if I look at myself, I was a person during the 1960s who at some points felt that King was too cautious, too conservative. I was more of a Malcolm person. And it took time to understand not only the negative consequences of violence in terms of who you're directing it toward, but the way in which the external rhetoric of violence of, say, the Black Power movement came back as internal violence within the Black Power movement. And I think only people who have been through those kinds of experiences begin to understand the message. And I think that for many people it takes a long time. So I think that although I would agree with what Dennis has said about the need to understand nonviolence the way King and Gandhi understood it, I think that that's a goal. It's not something that for most people happens just at the intellectual level of reading a book by King or reading a book by Gandhi and then becoming convinced. I think it's more likely to happen for people involved in movements that have a great diversity of understanding of tactics, and through hard-won experience come to some conclusions that may not exactly replicate King or Gandhi, because the situation in Burma might be different than the situation in the United States, or the situation in India, or the situation in the Philippines might be different, or the situation in South Africa might be different. But I think that by only looking at the purest expression of nonviolence, it prevents us from understanding that nonviolence basically won the battle in South Africa. You know, if the ANC had relied on the armed struggle, they would still be struggling today. But I think that one of the reasons why we don't understand the South African struggle as a victory for nonviolence and the nonviolent way is that too often we have too purist a definition of nonviolence.
Dennis Dalton, let me finish with you and ask you, in Gandhi's time and King's time, there was a charismatic leader in the form of these two men. Can nonviolence work without a charismatic leader who leads by example?
Well, the history of political movements has shown that charismatic leaders do constitute an indispensable, essential quality. And if we are to go in terms of the history of the great movements of our time, both violent and nonviolent, it seems that movements don't work without charismatic leaders. However, I don't think that nonviolence as a method should be limited by that consideration. It seems as though it does have, from a Gandhian point of view or a Kingian point of view, the potential to move beyond that, and one would hope that he'll be able to.
Dennis Dalton teaches political science at Barnard. He is author of Mahatma Gandhi, Nonviolent Power in Action. Claiborne Carson directs the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project at Stanford, where he teaches history. And as Dennis Dalton says, check out his he's the co-editor of The Papers of Martin Luther King Jr. Check those out. I want to thank you, both of you gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you, C.S. I really appreciate this.
Thank you very much.
And that archive discussion was first aired back on July 7th, 2000.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org, which has instructions for ordering CD copies of programs, links to related resources, and MP3 audio from recent shows, as well as ways of reaching C.S. and Sasha. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209.